Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Joe Prano Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Prano, and this is the season two premiere of the JPP. We had an extended break for the holidays. Got tough to wrangle people away from Christmas and New Year's and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and Martin Luther King Day and just repeated holiday watchings of Die Hard, I presume. So here we are, a new season, same great host, fantastic new guests. I'm super excited to bring you guys some new JPP content. Before we get to today's episode, a couple of business details to handle. I will be at the Pittsburgh Improv this weekend with Eddie Ift. That's January 26th and January 27th, the Saturday and Sunday of this week. I'll be there, two shows Saturday, one show Sunday, opening for my good friend Eddie. And you can get your tickets now on improv.com in Pittsburgh. We were supposed to do Thursday, Friday, and it has since been announced that Louis C.K. will be doing those shows instead. So we got bumped for Louis. He didn't even ask our permission. Usually he asks permission, but he did not ask our permission. And so he'll be doing Thursday and Friday, and we'll be doing Saturday and Sunday. Apparently I'm getting the same rate and doing half the shows. So I think I just got a pay raise, as far as I can tell. Works for me. Come and see me and Eddie at the Pittsburgh Improv this weekend. After that, I'm headed to New York City. I'll be doing Frantic, which is the fantastic Monday show that The Stand always runs. Their location is closed, so they're doing it at Rockwood Music Hall, and I'll be on that the 28th, Monday the 28th, so come see me on Frantic. And then I'll be at Empire City Yonkers Raceway, Empire City Casino, on Wednesday, January 30th. Before bouncing around the city to all kinds of other locations. So if you can't make any of those shows and you're in the New York metropolitan area, keep your eyes out on joeprano.com for dates. And if you're not in the New York City area and you want to know if I'm coming your way, which I might be coming your way soon. I'm coming to a lot of different places, and those dates are all up on my website at joeprano.com. So go there. If you're excited to see that I'm doing a new episode, you caught it on Twitter, you caught it on Instagram, you caught it wherever, and you haven't rated this podcast, reviewed this podcast, or subscribed to this podcast, please go and do that now. If you didn't see this episode today because you're already subscribed and you pulled it open in your podcast app and you're like, look, it's a new JPP, go to iTunes or Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or anywhere that podcasts are sold or given away for free, and subscribe to the show, because subscribing really helps, rating really helps, and reviewing is fantastic. I always love to hear your guys' feedback. Put it there in the reviews. I check the reviews every couple weeks. Put in the reviews that it's been too long since I did an episode, that you need more of them, that you can't get by without the JPP, that this is your favorite podcast, or that this is your least favorite podcast. Give me one star. Give me zero stars. Is it possible to give zero stars on iTunes? I don't know. Let's find out. Go do it. I don't care what you give me. Just give me an honest rating in iTunes. It helps a new show, which, despite being in season two, this still is. This is still a baby podcast as far as podcasts are concerned. I am very excited for today's episode. I have the owners and proprietors of Earth 2 Comics, a fantastic comic shop, comic book store here in Los Angeles. The owners, Car D'Angelo and Susan Avalone, were nice enough to join me on today's episode. And I'm stoked to have them on because, as some of you know, I enraged comic book fans recently by saying in passing that there are too many comic book movies these days. And I stand by that. I do. And just like I say on this episode that you're about to listen to, People have painted me the wrong way. I am a comic book fan. I had comic books growing up. I had graphic novels growing up. I have a Batman tattoo. The greatest Christmas of my life was when I came downstairs. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, and I had the Hall of Justice, where the Justice League, all of my characters, all of my action figures could now meet and solve the world's problems and plan to fight evil. I had the Hall of Justice. I think I called it on the episode, you'll hear it, I think I called it the Fortress, which was a momentary lapse. I was thinking Fortress of Solitude, and I said the Fortress. I know that's going to enrage some of you comic book fans even more, but again, that Christmas was 33 or so years ago, and I also regularly use medical cannabis for some of my ailments. So you'll have to excuse my memory in getting that one wrong. Don't kill me, but it's true. The greatest Christmas present I ever came down to was the Hall of Justice. My parents will tell you, my mom will happily tell you that I spent much of my childhood, much of it, in underoos. That's underwear and shirts with comic book characters on it. My mom can't wait to tell you that I spent many days in Wonder Woman underoos, because as a child, I loved all comic book heroes, man, woman, child. I didn't care. I am a comic book fan, and going to Earth 2 Comics was... brought me back to my childhood days when I would spend hours and hours bouncing between, you know, the baseball card store and the comic book store and the arcade and the movie theater, and it was fantastic. But you guys came at me because I said there's too many comic book movies, which I still believe there are. I don't need 10 Thors and 10 Captain Americas and 40 Spider-Men and 26 Avengers. I love that I just watched the latest Avengers movie. I watched Infinity War finally, and I loved it. It was great, but I don't need the 400 movies that go into that. We talk about on this episode how you know, all these comic book movies have kind of made the medium and the small size movie not a thing anymore, because why spend why spend $50 million making a movie to potentially make $200 million when you can spend $400 million making another Avengers and make billions of dollars? It's I still think there are too many, but as sort of an olive branch of peace to you comic book nuts out there, I really wanted to have Carr and Susan on the show. And it was awesome. I sat down in the comic book shop, and we talked all things comics. We talked what it's like to own a shop, comic book movies, their transition from the world of working in Hollywood to comic book retail, dealing with customers, the best comic book in their store, the most expensive comic in their store, everything. And it was awesome, and I think that you guys are really going to love it. I'm excited to get back to doing this podcast on the regular. This weekend was a great example of why. I woke up on Saturday morning, and I was dealing with the mayhem of a bunch of Catholic school MAGA kids in Washington, D.C., fighting with a Native American, and they were also fighting with Black Israelites, and they were also catcalling girls, and it turned out the Native American actually approached them, and the girl that they were catcalling was posting racist tweets, and on and on and on and on and on. And it's just, if you guys go back and listen to the prologue of the Joe Prano podcast, the teaser episode about all the reasons that I just needed to get away from all that and sit down with fun, creative, kind, special people, the weekend of all of that, going down all those paths, who's right, who's wrong, and then going like, I don't care, let's just talk to some great creative people, is precisely why I started this podcast in the first place, and precisely why I wanted to sit down with fantastic people like Carr and Susan and talk just something creative and fun and genuine like comics. So enjoy the episode. Enjoy the owners of Earth 2 Comics, a multiple location comic book shop here in Los Angeles, California, Carr D'Angelo and Susan Avalone. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show, guys.
Hey, Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey, Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up, and away we go. Mic check, and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
First of all, thank you for having me in the store. This is incredible. I feel like this is 12-year-old mind's dream. Like just being in a comic book store when it's not open and being able to just like poke around and not have to, you know, shove somebody to get a look at everything. This is fantastic. How long have you guys had this place?
It'll be 16 years in this coming March we open. We opened in 2003.
And we have a second store as well that we opened in
2009. So that's going to be the 10th anniversary this year.
And like I said, it's, you know, sort of every kid's dream to, when you're growing up, you're like, I'm going to own one of these one day. I'm going to have, what made you guys decide, like, we have to open a comic book store?
Well,
it was my idea to get him out of the house.
Basically.
That's the long and short of it.
I mean, we had moved out here to be in the movie business, and we did that. But my, you know, as a hobby, my interest was always comics. I mean, when I was a kid, I grew up in New York, reading comics, collecting comics, and all the big comic publishers, DC and Marvel, were in New York. So I always dreamed of getting a job there. And then, and I worked for a magazine in New York called Starlog that covered like science fiction movies and comic books and things like that. And that was sort of one step closer. But when we got married and moved out to Los Angeles and pursued movies, we did that for a while. But even being a producer, there's like a lot of dead time. You know, it's like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, and you can spend a year on a project and then the rock rolls down and all that work was for
the
nothing.
Word speculative is not a joke.
Yeah.
You know, everything is speculative. And there's, and that feels good and exciting when you've got ideas and projects that you're excited about, but you spend years in speculation and things don't reach their goal. And we're just goal. We both came from magazine editing, and it's like, no, you've got to get that article. You know, there's always a goal, and it's, there's a finished product. And so we just got, we're finished product people. And it was very frustrating to work on things for a long time and not have them.
So instead of going home when you don't have something to do, you can come here.
Well, in my downtime, I started, I mean, just for fun, because I was looking for things to buy. eBay had started like, what, around 1999 or something like that, 1998. And I was as a hobby buying things I wanted and selling, you know, sometimes I'd buy a larger collection and break it down and sell it. So I was doing that in some of my downtime between projects. I was also the movie business started taking more attention to comics. You know, it was post, you know, Batman was the big thing in, you know, 1989, but it was starting to sort of build up again. And, you know, we weren't quite yet in the Marvel era of, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but there was that budding interest. So I was looking at the comics business and how did it relate to movies and going to San Diego looking for projects to possibly option and all that kind of stuff. So I was putting a lot of time into comics, trying to marry the two things. And I was reading a lot about the business and about how the business at that time was changing from the periodical type of magazine comics and more into book product. And that was, you know, graphic novels was the phrase everybody was coining. And I'd run in and I'd go to Susan. I said, look, you know, here's this article I just read. And this part of the business is up 10% or 20% over last year. So that thing I was telling you, I think I was right. And then she said, maybe that would be a good side project. So you'll have something going
side
on.
Side project. Whenever you say side project, 10 years later, you wake up and you've done nothing else.
Right.
But that's what happens. You get, you know, we thought, ha ha, we can still pitch and take meetings and work on scripts and do retail 7 days a week,
right.
You know, and throw events and buy product 3 months in advance and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's your, you get on a different kind of train, and we still keep a little bit of that open, but it was just, it became hilarious after a while to even talk about, we're doing both.
Yeah.
Because it was just, this is so all encompassing.
When also I think about comic book stores when I was a kid in the 80s and the 90s, and they seemed like they were everywhere, and then they disappeared.
There was a bust, yeah.
There was a bust, and now I feel like in looking up, even just kind of doing some research for today, I was like, well, let's, you know, look at the best comic book stores in LA, and you guys are on all those lists, but there's more than I thought there would be. And I know there's obviously the boom with all the movies and everything, but 13, 15 years ago, that was a time where I imagine there wasn't a ton of comic book stores out there still.
No, part of the reason we opened a store in Sherman Oaks is because, again, Susan, you know, Susan's very smart. And one of the things she noticed was, why are you driving so far to get your comics?
You know, he was going 20 miles east or 20 miles west. He was right. going to like Woodland Hills or Burbank, you know, and it was
You're
going to
save
like,
money starting a store than paying for the gas.
You're supposed to do that kind of market research when you're developing any kind of business, but you don't have to do that market research if you're already a customer of that business. You don't have to do that kind of studying. He knew where the holes were, you know, and so you can sort of imagine, again, you know the business, how many TV and movie and creative people live in the Valley being served by so few stores. You go, okay, where isn't there one?
Right.
You know, where is there nothing? Where's that hole across the street from a Starbucks that's going to be built that you imagine is going to happen?
And in the 90s, there was a couple shops here in Sherman Oaks that I used to go to, and they one of them was actually owned by Forbidden Planet, which is the big comic book store in England, and they also have a big New York store. And it didn't, at a certain point, it didn't work, or whatever happened, they closed. So that was one of the reasons. Again, we recognized that this was an area that needed that shop. Also, you know, and one of the guys I went to down in Woodland Hills, his hours were so short that I would like have to race there because he would close at 6. So if I wanted to get my new comics after work, I'd have to like leave work early. I'd have to get on, you know, I'd be on the 101 calling him like, please, I'm 5 minutes away. It's, you know, 5:55. Please don't close. I'm going to pull up. Let me buy my comics. You know?
We do get those calls here too. No matter how many hours you're open, it's, you know, we're always pushing the envelope in Los Angeles,
right.
You know, and especially with the roads, we're sympathetic to people who have that issue.
And we were talking before we were recording, we were talking about when you were working at Universal. What were you doing when you were working there? And were you guys together then when you were both in the business?
Yeah, we got married in New York and moved out here together.
Okay.
And both of us worked in, you know, development, and Susan writes scripts as well. But, you know, we both sort of started with development jobs. I was a script reader at Universal and then became a development executive and a production executive working, you know. Again, the funny thing is I thought I was going to be working on big blockbuster movies because I thought that's where, you know, with the comic books and stuff, that's where my sensibility was. But it wound up being, and partially because it's what Universal was doing at the time, we just wound up doing a lot of comedy, low budget, you know, sort of on the fly, under the radar. It was great to do because when you're working for a studio, there's a lot of oversight, but there's a lot less oversight when you're working on like a $10 million movie. I know that $10 million is a lot of money, but for a studio that was making Waterworld, you know, for $200 million,
right.
You know, $10 million was like, oh, you're like, as long as you're on time. And we had a great producer, Bob Simons, who always would come in under budget. So, and that was his thing. He goes, as long as, if I give them back $500,000 at the end of the day,
they'll let me do
anything I want. They don't care because they saved money. I'm not the one going to them, you know, causing the problems, going, I need another week, I need this, I need that. So a really smart producer.
Happy.
So we got to have a lot of fun doing movies like, Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore I was supervising, Reality Bites with Ben Stiller, you know. And again, when I look at it, however many years later, you know, I like that they're movies that whenever I just turn on the TV, you turn on USA Network or whatever, you know, just the other night, I'm flipping channels and there's Billy Madison and a lot of the other movies at Universal and other people made. And we still watch it.
We still can't help, but it was the shampoo scene, you know, and that, I would always tell Adam, like, that's my favorite thing in the world, that shampoo and the conditioner having a conversation. Like, that's one of those moments for me with him that crystallized, like, why I love him so much, because we all do that.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like,
I can still see his face when they fall under the tub.
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah,
this sad,
right?
This
totally,
sad face.
Totally. Like, that's still,
that's such a classic shot.
Yeah. It just stops you and warms your heart and you just laugh and it's magical. It's still so much fun for me to see that stuff.
Now, you were talking about looking for
project, going down to San Diego, and sort of that 15 years ago, 16 years ago, that's really before, like you said, obviously before the Marvel Universe and everything that's happened, but that was in a time when comic book movies, besides the Batmans, sort of were all failures. Like everything that they tried, you know, we had Superman in the 70s and the 80s, and then Batman worked, but then they tried everything, and it was always just, it just didn't live up to those films, and it seemed like it was that they were like, we're not going to try to spend the money on these anymore. We spend too much, and they don't make anything. And what at the time, what were you thinking in terms of, oh, I'm going to go search for those?
Well, it wasn't about superheroes. A lot of what was going on, because it was the beginning of, you know, what's the phrase? You know, the geek shall inherit the earth. I mean, and that's sort of what happened in Hollywood. All the guys who grew up reading comics in the 70s and 80s became executives, producers, and
directors.
They saw the value in this, you know, in this material, but they weren't necessarily going after the, you know, I mean, you knew Batman was at Warner's, and you knew Marvel actually was in bankruptcy and all sorts of had, you know, problems at the time. But there was a lot of interest in finding, just as a source for new material. You know, because there was always a lot of projects. I'm trying to think of examples, but even things like Turtles, you know, was an indie book that turned into a, you know, obviously it had its history as animation, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but you had the cartoons and everything, and it was really big as a movie. X-Men and Spider-Man, which were around, you know, 2001 or something like that, still, you know, began that beginning of, oh, maybe there's something here. But a lot of producers were going down looking for like crime stories and science fiction stories, and they were just looking for good material that was off the grid. Because, I mean, when I was at the studio in the 80s, everything was about books. It was all about John Grisham and, you know, buy that novel. That novel is the secret to a blockbuster movie. The Color Purple, all those kinds of things.
As a development exec, your job was to, like, hound those New York agents to give you those early galleys. Like, we fought over them. We, you know, that's what all the phone calls were about every day. It's like, who's got that manuscript? You know, when things were sold on, like, the first chapter or a 10-page treatment, because people were very hungry. There was a real hunger for material then, as he said, for a big story that we hadn't seen before. It wasn't necessarily superheroes, but it was just like, give me that good big stuff.
And the development executives who had some experience with comics thought, oh, I've got an in. And I think also they wanted to go to Comic-Con and write it off. But I would, you know, but we'd almost be in a line. We'd be in like a conga line, especially with the independent creators going around and going, hey, how you? Maybe I can buy you lunch later. And, oh, we should talk about this. This looks interesting. Oh, it's got cops and robbers in it. Maybe there, is it a caper? Oh, maybe there's something there. And some of those movies, like, you know, Whiteout with Kate, you know, Beckinsale was, you know, Steve Lieber's graphic novel. There are a lot of things that have come out of that. Atomic Blonde a couple years ago was based on a graphic novel series, and a lot of those things have come out. They're not necessarily branded as obviously as the Marvel and DC movies are, because
like if you're just a regular moviegoer, you have no idea that's from.
Yeah,
but it grows out of that whole thing.
Yeah, just it says, you know, it's like, you know, being based on a British TV series. It's like, it's just, we're looking for something that, hey, someone else did it. We can look at it first and get an idea that it works, and then, you know, and you know, the joke is always comics are their own storyboards. I mean, which really isn't true, because a lot of the comic storytelling doesn't always translate into movies. But there's a visual reference. There's something that was helping people sell the idea to studios. When I was at Universal, like in the early, when Batman came out, what happened first was producers literally would go to the comic shops in town and just buy up, without even having the rights to things, just buy up graphic novels and comic books and walk them over to a studio executive's office and go, here, I'm submitting these. And then when I became a reader, I raised my hand and said, let me read all the comics. Because everyone else was reading the comics and going, this is a comic book. I don't get it. So I said, look, I'm not gonna love everything because it's a comic book. Let me read the comics and I'll tell you, this one has potential. This one has this. This has a premise. This, you know, because sometimes, you know, there is some, there's a kernel of something that could be a movie more than other things.
And Carr had an area of expertise at a time when a lot of people in his position didn't. So again, I can brag on him better than he can. He put the Hulk into development and Archie's and Mad Men by Michael Allred. And, you know, when Variety wrote about it, he was the comic book guy, you know, different meaning of it at the time.
Right.
It was Variety's meaning of it.
Yeah.
You know, this is the guy that's, you know, gets these comic book
now
projects.
Comic book guy means something completely different.
Yes. But that's what it meant then. And it was kind of an anomaly. It was like, you know, again, it was like doing the Sandler movies. It was sort of like doing, you have to, in Hollywood, you have to do the thing nobody else is doing, but it's close enough to what everybody else is doing. And it was, he was always trying to find, you know, that next thing. And the store came out of that idea of finding the, you know, what's the next thing? Always looking for the next thing that people are going to enjoy.
And it was kind of like a secret club too, finding out who were the other, you know, comic book guys in, you know, at other production companies.
You guys
or
all
other
had decoder students. Rings.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You could see each other from across the room.
The writer I hired, John Turman, to write the Hulk, we met because we were on another project together that I was just assigned to, and we're sitting in a development meeting about, and it was a science fiction time travel story that John had written that was really good. And in the middle, I sort of said, so it's a kind of a parallel worlds kind of thing. And he said, do you mean like an Earth 2? I mean, it's funny because it's the name of the store, Earth 2. But he goes, like an Earth 2 kind of thing. And we just kind of looked at each other like, oh, if you're talking that way, we got to talk later. You know,
it was we're like, having lunch.
Not in front of everybody else. Don't talk about comic book ideas in front of everybody, because it was, you know. But then you'd find out. I had friends who, you know.
Well, now you have to explain. So what is the Earth 2?
Oh,
I'm a guy who read comic books, and then, you know, 13, I get into girls, and
right.
I'm just like, bye,
right.
You know, like that, and I never look back. But I, when I come in to the store, I'm like, yes, this takes me back to, like, all, I wish I could do it again, you know what I mean? And I can, and when I walk in, I go, I can do it again, like, I can
people
go.
People do.
Yeah, because girls have ran their course, and I think I'm going to go back to comic books.
They'll always be here for you.
Yeah.
They're always here.
So Earth 2, where's the name comes from?
Earth 2 is in the DC Comics universe, and now it's on mentioned on the Flash
TV show all the time.
But it kind of was a when I put it on the name of the store, it was a bit of a dead concept in comics, but it had kind of an evocativeness for me and a sentimentality for me. And it's basically, when comics began in the 1930s and 1940s, you know, superheroes were the big thing. There was Superman, Batman, Flash, Wonder Woman. Then there was kind of, again, a bust in the 50s, and comics stopped doing as well. There was the comics code. There was concerns about violence. So a lot of the comics got canceled. So a lot of the Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman survived, but most of the other heroes, like the Flash and the Green Lantern, kind of went away. Then in the late 50s, DC Comics was trying to revive some of their old titles. And so they came up with a new Flash and a new Green Lantern. And they were different from the old school ones from the 1940s. And, you know, and fans were like welcoming, and they were big hits, and it was a great idea. And they also then introduced this thing, the Justice League of America,
right.
Which was all the heroes together. There used to be in the 40s a Justice Society of America. Now, of course, fans started asking, what happened to the Justice Society of America? What happened to the Golden Age Flash? What happened to the Golden Age Green Lantern? Can't they meet? And they eventually made them meet. Now, the audience can't see it, but I can point out a visual reference. Right here is Flash Comics 123, and it's the first meeting, the yellow one down there.
Yep.
And it's the first meet, Flash of Two Worlds. And in that book, Flash, the new Flash, meets the original Flash from the 1940s by crossing over from one dimension into another dimension. They don't live on the same world.
Right.
So they have Earth 1 and Earth 2. Now, of course, the new heroes were kind of had big egos, so they called their Earth Earth 1,
right.
and the original Earth Earth 2. So the irony is that actually Earth 2 is the place where that birthed the original superheroes.
Are you lost yet?
No, I'm following. But
in 1938, yeah. When Action Comics number 1 came out and Superman premiered, that was on Earth 2 again.
You know? Yeah.
Let's start that. Yeah. We can start that right here, right now.
Well, but that's the thing. In the 80s, they sort of destroyed all the Earths because they thought it was too confusing. And so so when when we opened the shop in 2003, Earth 2 didn't really exist in the comics. It was kind of a nostalgia thing, but that was a little bit of the vibe you know, that I wanted. And I always liked comic book shops that were named after a place. I hated...
We tried using it in a sentence. You know, to me, it's always like, you have to, when you're naming something, you have to think the rest of your life you're going to use it in a sentence. I'm going to blank. And you have to fill in the blank.
Right.
And so that's how he talked me into it, because I didn't know what it meant, but I kept wanting it to sound like a place. You know, like, I like Our Friends Have Secret Headquarters. I love that name.
Yeah.
You know, like, I loved, I think somebody loves saying to their person they live with, hey, I'm going to Secret Headquarters. It sounds like fun. And I wanted to have something that sounded like it was a fun place
the
that
shop,
you were going to.
The shop that was in Sherman Oaks in the 90s that closed was called the Phantom Zone. And that was like the joke. Susan would go, where are you going on Saturday afternoon? I said, oh, I'm going to go over to the Phantom Zone. And it just sounded, you know, I was going to another place.
And if so, you're walking by somebody when you say you're going,
exactly. It sounds exciting.
You should be going to the doctor to get his prescription.
So anyone who comes here gets to go to Earth 2. They get to go to another world where the glory days of superheroes never ended.
Yeah, and they're stepping outside of their regular world. He wanted to call it the Cosmic Treadmill, and he still thanks me for not letting him because I just kept going, like, again, this is LA. I was like, that sounds like a new age fitness place.
Yeah.
It's like if I drove by the Cosmic Treadmill on Ventura Boulevard, I would think that's somebody combining, you know, fitness and woo-woo.
Right.
Like, you would set it up tomorrow and somebody would show up.
And it's one of those crazy comic book ideas that I love. The Cosmic Treadmill is the machine that Flash runs on to go from Earth 1 to Earth 2.
Wow.
So that was the...
It's cool, right? Yeah. But wouldn't you, again... Anybody with any kind,
too,
you know, too many double meanings, just too many double meanings. It's something you really have to think about and sit on and play with for a while. And you don't know have a good name until much, much later. You know, it's sort of like you have to live with something for a while and then you go, wow, I'm so glad we called this place that because it feels so right every time someone says it, every time I see it written down. You know what I mean? It takes a while to kind of.
And what's caught up with us is that now, you know.
Oh, yeah. Now so many people know what it is.
10-year-old kids who watch the Flash TV show, which is a big hit for them, come in and go, Earth 2, I know what this means, you know, and then it's kind of like, okay, great, the cycle is beginning anew.
So you pointed out this Flash comic,
yeah,
and to explain Earth 2, now we've got the Cosmic Treadmill, and I just see that we're sitting right in front of this comic, and it's dead center in the middle of the store, and it's in its thing. Is this a centerpiece?
Oh, yeah.
Comic?
I mean, it's for sale. Everything's for sale. I never, you know, I always hate, I mean, we have a few things that are quote unquote fixtures. There's pieces of art or something that are on loan or just are part of the decoration of the store that are kind of permanent. But generally, yeah, no, I used to hate going into comic book stores and you'd go, how much is this? And the owner, you know, like the guy in The Simpsons would go, oh, I'm sorry, that's my personal collection. I'm just showing it off to make you feel jealous today. You know, and
we didn't want to do too much of that.
You know,
we have a few pieces.
That guy really haunts every comic
book. Oh, totally.
Oh, totally.
Totally.
Jeff Albertson, man.
Yeah. Totally. No.
What makes a comic book valuable?
That's a great question.
Randy's question, so you can give her a little nod for that.
Yay, hey, Randy's very smart.
Come on. When you give it to me, and then it gets a great question, then you got to get your props.
She's got to get her props. It's very good of you.
See?
I mean,
you got coffee. You get props, too.
As with anything, the
rarity.
The value comes
it's always
from
be rarity, supply and demand.
Rarity and desirability. And one of the things that's going on in the back issue market right now, because of all the media, there's a fascinating relationship between the movies and TV shows and comic books, because there's a rise in value for what we call first appearances.
Mm-hmm.
So the first time a character appears in a comic, like Black Panther is a great example. You know, last year was the year of Black Panther, and we're probably looking at Oscar nominations. And that's a character who was introduced as a character in the Fantastic Four comics. So there was eventually a Black Panther comics number one, but you have an issue of Fantastic Four 52, I won't say because I may get it wrong. Somewhere in the 50s.
You don't want to piss off the,
I don't
the people
want to,
who know.
They're
going to
go, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's
talking about. They'll hear about it.
This guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
He owns
I'm
a
never coming there again.
But 51, I think it's 52 and then 53. Yeah, that's it. But that's a book that, you know, I have a point of sale system that shows me my sales for the last 10 or 12 years. And I can look, I sold that, you know, what I sold that book for 10 years ago. It's always been a popular book because Black Panther is a popular character, but all the, when the movies come out, first appearance of Groot, first appearance of Rocket,
it's like
Raccoon,
mm-hmm. You know, you can watch it sort of go up and down.
So in terms of what's making things valuable now, That's the main thing. Looking for those first appearances of characters who then achieve new popularity in the media, mostly because more people, you know, more people want them.
And we always keep our eye on that stuff. You know, we still read Variety and Deadline, you know, for a lot of reasons, partly also because I will text him in the middle of the day and go, somebody just bought this comic for, you know, like Deadly Class that was just on the other night. It's like, right, when that gets announced, you know, when Jessica Jones got announced, you know, it's like, boom, we got to, you know, we see the news, we put up a display, we find everything we have. Yeah, you know, when the Guardians movie came out, he was always a big Rocket Raccoon fan. So kind of someone who knew that was going to be a great character and a great piece of property. And it took a lot of people by surprise. But for him, the second we saw the ad, he was like, oh, I think I've got a box of Rocket Raccoon comics in the garage, yeah, because I saved them and, wow, I loved them. And now they're going to have value.
If you guys, I mean, and you are just proximity and having worked in the
absolutely
business, you're ahead of the game, but you see something or you get a hint or you know something's happening, how do you acquire what is here? Or is it all, I mean, not everything.
A lot of it's here. We look
the,
around.
Right.
Yeah, we look around.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of old stuff, I mean, people bring, you know, want to sell collections, whether it's someone who, you know, just doesn't want to collect anymore, someone who's older, you know, sometimes it's someone's, you know, passed away and it's an inherited collection. But a lot of times it's just people want to, you know, they're moving. I mean, we're in a transient, you know, Los Angeles is a transient community. People have, you know, good times and bad times because they're in the business. And it's like, oh, I'm moving back to Oklahoma, so I can't take my 10 boxes of comics in my, you know.
And very often it's I'm moving in with a woman.
Right.
Like, yeah. I don't know how many times. No, like if we had to track the number of like different reasons why people come to us, you know, there's death. There's I found a storage facility. I moved into a house that had something in its closet. But my favorite is always I'm moving in with someone who said you can't have an entire room of this stuff, you know, and your entire room of this stuff has to go away so I can bring my stuff and actually live with you. Well, if you want to live with another person.
I gotta imagine the percentage of those that work out are low, right? They're like, take everything you love and sell it to these guys.
No, that, and it's true. And I always think, you know, again, you have to make compromises when you're in a relationship. Yeah. We've been in one a long time, so I'm well aware of that. But I also always, you know, sometimes we have that moment. I know you had one once with a sad guy who was packing up his stuff, and he was sort of having that moment of, I should have known we weren't suited for each other for how she felt about this stuff. You know what I mean? Like, when someone can't respect... There's compromise in living together, and you can't have a room of statues, you know, because that's overkill.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's an adult conversation. But you never want to be in a relationship with somebody, whether it's comics or sports or anything, where their entire life is looking down at that thing that you love, because that's probably not going to have long. You know what I mean? That's not going to wear well.
But a lot of times it is also just maturation of someone going,
I need to have
a nursery. I don't need to have a comic book room, you know?
Yeah,
and that's a reasonably mature.
That's a happy one when people are just making an adult decision of we have too much stuff and we're making room for something else.
Yeah. And then there's also new stuff just as, you know, it's just, again, anticipating, you know, like, you know, the Marvel Infinity Wars movie was somewhat based on a graphic novel called Infinity Gauntlet. So you just kind of have to be aware and make sure you have that in stock, because over that period of time leading up to the movie, you're going to have more people walking in and going, hey, do you have something that's like that movie I liked? And also because we're in Los Angeles and Hollywood, what I love, sometimes I hear about things because when they started the Walking Dead series, and what was that, maybe 10, 12 years ago?
Yeah.
And it was a successful graphic novel series, comic book series, you know, Robert Kirkman's, created something great and went on to create a hit TV series from it. But people started coming in because they were going up for the jobs.
We get the production designers and the cinematographers
and
people who want the source material.
Research.
One of my favorite moments was a woman coming in and going, do you have any Walking Dead comics that I can look at? And, you know, we showed her the books, and she was going up for the job of costume designer. And she heard what it was with the zombies, and she thought, oh, this is going to be kind of boring because
clothing, you know, the cliche kind of,
and also that it must be, you know, it's going to just be normal clothing because, you know, there's going to be limitations on the job because, well, they're in the apocalypse, they're not changing clothes, you know, every week, obviously. And but what she found fascinating is when she picked up the book, the comic book is in black and white, and suddenly, like, her face lit up. She goes, I get to pick the colors. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, oh, this isn't going to be a bad, this is going to be a pretty cool job.
Yeah, we love it. That's like, I love the opposite reaction
I have. I'm like, great. I only have to do two colors. This lazy man, like, oh, perfect. No, they've already told me what they're going to wear.
No, she realized like there were certain things.
There was something
kinda,
she could add to it. Yeah, you know, something she could bring to it for
that's
her own portfolio.
Goes, oh, so
for...
I can decide what this character wears and what that character, because you're only seeing, you know, all you're seeing is a t-shirt in the comic book.
Now, it seems like, you know, back in the day, it was almost the comic book fans were driving studios and TV and everybody to make comic book properties, and now, like you're saying, people see the movies and now they're coming to the comic book store to find that. Let's talk a little bit about just the explosion of the comic book world in film. It seems like this would be your perfect time to, like, this is, you were working in it when it wasn't happening as much.
Right.
Would you go back now? It seems like everything is...
Oh, he would go back.
Lined up.
No,
for
he would.
You.
He would make.
You're a comic book guy.
No, but he would make a movie tomorrow. I mean, we would if we found something that we wanted to do and the time and, you know.
People always go, you know, well, why did you leave the movie business for your comic book store? And I go, you know, it's not like I had to file a resignation or something.
You know? We say the movie business fires you. You don't fire the movie business.
No, it was a mutual breakup.
Yeah.
No, you just sort of, you know, yeah, you're not as busy. You're chasing people around. It's like, look, it's also, you know. I'm
people always ask him, we joke because people always ask him, you know, after Ant-Man especially came out, you know, the question we always got, especially from our old friends in the development world and anybody that comes in here that works for a writer or a director or an actor, what's the next Ant-Man? You know, can you guys tell me, you know, we're like, again, with Rocket Raccoon.
That's,
you know,
on
can
my
you,
list of questions.
Can you
what's
tell me, yeah, can you tell me what's that obscure character
that
no one's heard of that's going to make me a zillionaire?
Yes.
And we always go, if we knew, we would have optioned it.
Right.
I'm so sorry. Like, I'm not going to give you the zillion-dollar idea. You're free to look around and see for yourself. It has to, again, you know, to succeed in any kind of business, you can't just go like, this is the thing people want. You have to like it too, because you're going to spend a lot of time with it. So to me, whenever someone asks that question, I'm sort of like, this isn't going to work out for you.
Right.
You know, I always want to say, this isn't going to work out for you. You don't understand. You're going to have to bleed for this. Like, you're going to have to spend time with people you don't like. You're going to have to drive all over town for 3 years, maybe 5, maybe 10. You know, like, think about it, Randy. You know, like, that's what the job is. And people think, oh, I'm going to find Ant-Man on the shelf. I'm going to hand it to whoever. And then I'm going to get ka-ching.
And
yada yada yada.
I've got a yacht.
Yeah, I'm at the premiere. You know, kissing Kate Blanchett. You know, I'm at the premiere, kissing Kate Blanchett, and all is well. And that's just not, you know what I mean. Yeah, he would do it for that.
Yeah.
But if we found that property that really he's pursued a couple properties over the years. We both have. We've optioned books that we've loved. You know, and there's still that moment of, yeah, maybe we'll do that. And if something came through here that we both felt like, oh my God, like, we have to pursue this before anybody else does, you know, we would do it. We would make that call. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I know we would, but mostly we don't have time, you know, and the funny thing is how I often pitch the books and things that I like here to this community. Like, there's a book called Lumberjanes. There's a series called Lumberjanes that's been out for several years now, and it's one of our top sellers from Boom Comics. And it's girls in the woods. It's like Girl Scouts meets the X-Men. You know, they're having these great adventures. There's ghosts and there's weird things in there, but they're basically girls camping and getting badges and stuff like that. And it's a great feminist book.
They get, like, their Bigfoot badge and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's really terrific. And literally, again, as people in the business, you know, having been in the business, the first time he showed me that property in the catalog and turned to me and just said, Lumberjanes. I went, oh my God. Like, that's a movie. That's a TV show. That's going to run forever. We invested heavily in it when it came out. We love the property. We love the company. It was, you know, it was easy for us to kind of push, you know, give it to everybody that walked through the door.
Right.
And I had all these parents walking through the door and I would go, this is going to be a TV show someday. Like, it might be 10 years from now, but your kid should get in because this is fantastic. It's going to live a long time and people don't want to, you know, whether it's TV or comics, people don't like investing in things that are going to go away. And we don't want to sell them things that they're just going to piss them off later.
Right.
So we have to kind of have that
is
sensibility.
Is there a pressure to that? To people coming in and being like, what should I? And like having to pick something that really
Recommendations are constant. I mean,
that's our job.
It's our – it's it's one of the few things we have, say, against, you know, Amazon. I mean, I know Amazon's got their algorithms and stuff, but people come in and, you know, and I love, you know, the idea of, you know, older folks who you know, come in and want to ask my, you know, my 25-year-old staff, what's good? I mean, there's just a you know, mutual respect that's really, but that's what people want, because there is so much product. I mean, you're looking around. I mean, I've got how many different, you know,
yeah, we haven't, you know, read all these books on the shelf. We try to,
right,
you know, to tell people about them, but it's an impossibility. Right. So you focus on the ones that you really, you know, yeah, you have to sort of focus on the
and
ones that you
and especially
in.
As we get into sort of the non, you know, I mean, we've talked a lot about the superhero stuff, but the other thing that is going on in graphic novels today is the young adult market, and also the independent alternative or whatever you want to call it market, where there are memoirs like Fun Home, which became the big musical. There's a lot of stories that aren't just, you know, crime fighting and superheroes and stuff like that. And so, you know, those customers need more of a guide, because it's not,
you have to find a way to explain it to them.
Yeah. When you're not talking about, you know, obvious genre stuff, trying to draw, you know, make recommendations that people are, you want people to enjoy it. I mean, there's certain books that we'll give sort of a guarantee to that if you don't like this, bring it back. But this is, you know, this one's
Saga.
Got like a 95%, you know, penetration.
Saga comes with, Saga always comes with a guarantee. You know, there's certain things, again, that for us are solid gold, Lumberjack, you know, there's certain things that we know the audience, we know this person, and we'll ask people, what kind of movies do you like? What kind of TV do you like? And it's like, oh, this is, we know you're going to love this. And if you don't, just bring it, you know, again, we don't do it with everything, but with some things we can say, if you don't love this, bring it back. We'll sell it 5 seconds later.
Yeah.
Because this has such a following and such, you know, it's so beloved.
I drew the ire of, you know, sort of the comic book fan recently, because I said I thought the superhero movie thing is sort of getting overdone to the point where, like, I can't keep up with it. And I had to say, I have a Batman tattoo. Like, I appreciate,
I'm legit.
I appreciate a good comic book and a good comic book character and a good comic book movie. But I said, it's just, I can't keep up. It's too much. Do you guys think that there's any truth to there being an oversaturation of the superhero?
I would have said that until Spider-Man came out. I mean, the ultimate, you know, the Spider-Man that's out now, the animated the Spider-Verse. I mean, I have never, again, in our years here, of all the impacts that we've seen movies have, I mean, we always say Iron Man was kind of the first time we really saw an impact. You know, when we had a 5-year-old little blonde girl run through the door and go, Iron Man, give me Iron Man. And I was like, Robert Downey Jr., this is your fault.
Yeah.
You know, like, you're totally responsible for this. And I agree with you. I think people have a fatigue with it, you know, the sameness of it, and people will get, you know, we'll see it here. But then you have that movie that comes out, and oh my God, you have the little kid coming in here in Spider-Man head to toe and going, I'm Miles Morales. And we have our staff and seeing it 5 times, and we're just hearing from everybody younger than us, particularly, this is life changing. And you have to listen to that. You know, you can't go by your own standards all the time.
Right.
I mean, Spider-Man was created, you know, in 1961, 62, whatever it was, to be in a reaction to sort of the square-jawed Batman and Superman heroes of DC. Stan Lee and Steve Ditko wanted Spider-Man to be
accessible.
So he was a high school student, like the kids they thought were reading, you know, comics, and he was a science nerd, and he got bullied, and all these things happened to him, and then he put on, you know, the Spider-Man costume, and that, you know, and it was a wish fulfillment fantasy. And it's funny to see, though, that even Spider-Man became so much the status quo that Miles Morales is now having the same effect that Peter Parker had in the 60s. Miles Morales is the underdog. Miles Morales is the character that, you know, kids and people are relating to, and it's like, oh wow, that's what it should be. And not to bring it back to Earth 2, but even that whole idea that was started with that is, there's great concepts and mythologies here, but sometimes they do have to be recycled, rebooted, and that's, you know, that's what kind of keeps it fresh.
For the current person.
But in terms of your question, no, I probably shouldn't say this, but yes, is there too many? I can't believe how many superhero movies there are. I mean, I can't believe when you look at it per year, you know, but that's been, and again, that's what made me sort of lose interest in, not the comic book part of it, but what made me lose interest in the movie business is there was a time
so little when original material,
a good idea, a good piece of talent could kind of like move a project, And now you're so hard pressed to find projects that are not based on all this. Everything is derivative material. Everything is a remake. Everything is a, you know.
Carr worked on Lorenzo's Oil. Do you remember Lorenzo's Oil?
Yeah.
We love talking about Lorenzo's Oil, especially because Bob's Burgers just did an episode called Lorenzo's Oil. And when we saw it come across the screen, we grabbed each other. We're like, oh my God, people are still talking about Lorenzo's Oil. But that was such a famous movie in Universal history because you could never make that movie. You can't pitch that movie to anybody. Nobody wants to see that movie about a little kid dying and the mother trying to save them. But that was a beautiful script and a beautiful movie and a beautiful story. And he always loved to tell how it got like this A cinema score that everybody who saw it said it was like the greatest movie they'd ever seen in their lives. But then when they were asked that second question of whether you would recommend it to somebody, it was like, no.
It got the highest disparity between quality of the movie, A plus. Would you recommend it? Only 30% people would recommend it.
Like, because they all write,
I couldn't, my friends have kids. I couldn't recommend this movie to them.
Like, and that just, to me, that was like the business in a nutshell, you know, was sort of like, you know, this is such a fabulous movie that it exists and it's life changing and it's wonderful and it will always be remembered and referred to and it will always be important, but it'd be a very hard movie to make right now, especially for theatrical release. You'd probably make it for HBO.
And then he made Babe. And George Miller.
Yeah, I love Babe.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, exactly. You couldn't do that now. It would not be big enough.
And that's sort of my criticism as a fan of just, you know, I love going to the movies and I love watching movies and, you know, I want to see stuff. I'll go see the superhero movie and I want to see Lorenzo's Oil.
Totally.
And it's like I said, you know, I had to defend myself. The greatest day of my life was when I came down in the Justice League, you know, the fortress was under the Christmas tree. I was like, this is it. this is my,
this is
like,
as good
it's
as
not
going
to get better than this. But now I'm also like, I can't see other kinds of movies because it seems like they've been pushed aside. And it's like, why put any single dollar toward that when, you know.
Right, they don't need me.
Then, when we could just do another Iron Man that's, you know, it's Iron Man's kid. It's Iron Man Jr.
Right, it's Iron Man's cousin.
Like, how many Spider-Mans have there been since Tobey Maguire? Are we on our, like, fourth?
Yeah.
Spider-Man, you know?
He's like James Bond at this point.
Yeah.
Well, again, that's true. I grew up on James Bond movies, and there's no reason why there shouldn't keep being James Bond movies. I would always compare to people, you know, the superhero universe, like General Hospital, you know, like when your grandmother watched the soap operas. And it's sort of like if you walked in the room and a bunch of characters were on television having a conversation, you'd go, they're speaking another language. Like, I can't get into this. There's too much history. And that's how I feel about the superhero stuff. There's so many years of history. The scenes mean more to him than they're ever going to mean to me. I can see it happening. When people are talking on screen, I can watch his face and go, oh, he gets something here that I do not understand.
Right, no, there's
like, there's another layer here that's going on that I can't access. So it's fun, but it's not. I'm with you.
Right.
It's saturation, and I can't go.
And it's less artful as a movie. I mean,
exactly.
It is. It's button pressing. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the Star Wars movies now too. I mean, it's, I enjoy them, but I enjoy them more because it's like, you know, the member berries from, you know, South Park.
Right.
It's like member Han Solo member. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, and it's fun, and it just tickles me in a nostalgic way more, but I don't necessarily think that means it's great filmmaking.
Yeah, you don't walk out talking about the structure.
And I still want to see a movie that makes me go, oh my God, that's a story I haven't seen or, you know, don't know anything about and get totally drawn in. And that happens less and less and less.
Obviously, when we brought up Spider-Man and we started talking about Spider-Man, you mentioned Stan Lee.
Yes.
Passed away recently.
Yes.
How did his death change the demand for comics, and how did, you know, being in the comic book world, just on the day that happens, what happens here at Earth too?
Well, one of the nicest things that the staff reported to us, Heather, who's here almost every day, said she was so touched that people who don't even shop here were like opening the door and shouting in, I'm so sorry for your loss. And she was like, thank you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, the world got it.
Yeah.
You know, the world got that we lost a leader and our, you know, somebody that meant something to everybody, and everybody had a personal interaction with him pretty much. And so it was really wide ranging and deep. And I loved that people who didn't even like comics were just kind of aware that there should be some respect paid to this man. You know, it was very sweet. It was really like moving.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was, I mean, in terms of superhero comics and Marvel specifically, obviously, he really was the face of, you know, the of the industry. And, you know, I mean, I'm fortunate I got to work with him when I worked on the Hulk movie for Universal. He was one of the producers and part of it, and, you know, a lovely man and so sweet and
now,
friendly.
This is Ed Norton Hulk?
No, this was
first Hulk.
We were doing, we were developing a Hulk movie that was like the later Marvel movies where it was based on the comics. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, and it's funny when Stan even first came in, he goes, "Oh, you probably don't want to do something that's like the comics." So we have this other idea for the Hulk. And I'm like, "Stan, I hate to tell you, we're going to do it the way you wrote it. And that's the way we're going to do it. I'm just telling you that right now." And so we tried to do that kind of basic origin story that you kind of saw in Iron Man. I mean, without going into it, there's similar stories in the fact that they were both Cold War era heroes, and the premise was the guy who creates the weapons becomes the weapon. Mm-hmm. You know, in Iron Man's case, it's a tragedy because it's the only way to you know, the tragedy is it's the only way to save his life. He has to become this armored knight, you know, to keep his heart going. And with the Hulk, it's in order, he saves someone else's life, but he saves a kid from a bomb, but by getting exposed to the radiation, he becomes the Hulk. All the TV stuff, you know, of, you know, breaking through the adrenaline and stuff like that was a whole TV concept. So most people don't really know, and they still haven't done it in the movies, the original Hulk story, but it was a Cold War metaphor. And we wanted to go back to, you know, go back to that.
And that was producer Galen Hurd, who really, understood it and appreciated it and respected it.
So we were developing a version. There's a great other, I mean, I don't know if I should mention other podcasts, but there's a podcast recently that did a whole history of, the Hulk movie.
Yeah, do you guys talk to each other?
I can't even name it.
Podcast fans will just spend the whole day listening. So okay.
Right.
You giving them something else to do.
It was fascinating. It was just fascinating, the idea that, and they knew a lot. They got some things wrong, but it was amazing how much they knew about the history, because the project went through 1,000 drafts, and everybody except for us, everybody kept getting away from the comic book version of the Hulk, because everybody at that time was saying, you can't do comics, until Sam Raimi did Spider-Man and did it like the comics and did it the Stan Lee, Steve Ditko way. And then Ang Lee and James Seamus got involved, and they wanted to just do something. I mean,
became a director's movie. I mean, right. in the sense of it was more about his stuff. That is a movie where some, you know, the comics book fans might not find the story so satisfying, but as a piece of work, as a piece of cinematic work, right.
To do it as a tone poem to this idea of the Hulk more than they wanted to do a Hulk movie. But apparently, the story that went around, though, was because they were in parallel development or parallel, James Seamus apparently went to a screening of Amazing Spider-Man by Sam Raimi, which is such a classic comic book movie, and came out of it while they were cutting the Hulk and called Ang Lee and said, "We really fucked up." Like, they're going to kill us now, because this guy proved you could do – we were doing it on the argument that you couldn't do it the comic book way, and Sam Raimi just schooled everybody in how you do it. And that really, I think, set the tone for the Marvel Cinematic, you know, even though it was separate from
the
MCU.
Those movies were gonna be.
It really gave Marvel the power to be able to go, we're going to do it our way. Our stories were good. All those little notes that you guys give are wrong, and and Stan was part of that. Stan being the ambassador – and as I said before, in the 80s, in the 90s, all these guys, we secretly were like having lunch with Stan Lee, and I'd have, you know, friends who were other writers. I just called Stan Lee at his office and said I was a big fan, I could have lunch, and Stan loved the attention, because he wasn't getting the love in the mid-90s. He was, you know, like I said, Marvel was having financial problems, he was doing cartoons, he wasn't a movie presence.
But he made himself, but he became a movie presence by making himself so available.
Yes.
And so, you know, cooperative and collaborative and intrigued by people's ideas, instead of being that guy. If he'd have been the guy shutting stuff down, nothing would have happened. Right. You know what I mean? It was because of his largesse and his belief in it, and that's what really carried the day.
And yeah, and he wasn't like, oh, my way or the highway. He was he was always open to good ideas.
Exactly. We've all witnessed things where something gets shut down because the holder of the thing is so precious about it, they don't let anybody run with it, but he always had that willingness, like, hey, have fun with my stuff. And that that made all the difference.
Yeah, I mean, the downside of when he passed, I mean, there's always a little ghoulishness of people going, hey, you know, I got something signed by Stan Lee. That's worth $1 million now, right? It's like, you know.
And Instagram's just everybody's picture with him. And yeah. Like, okay,
Yeah, and then the unfortunate part of his, I mean, of his, the last few years of his life, I mean, his wife had passed away. I saw him do a talk about a year and a half before he passed away, and he was on All Points, and it was a great interview that he did live on stage for a charity called Hero Initiative, and that was great, and then his wife had passed away, but the sad part was he was mostly for the purposes of other people, I think more than his own financial interests, he was kind of put on the road as we're gonna do these picture things,
like a politician almost.
And the good news, bad news, it was almost like a Twilight Zone kind of trap of like he was there with the fans, but he wasn't getting the attention he should have gotten is put him on a podium like the thing we were at. Let him tell his stories, let people cheer and laugh and really enjoy him and let him feed off that energy instead of just, because I don't think you get the same kind of interaction just sitting behind, you know, because they wouldn't let people talk to him. They just wanted to move through as many people as possible.
Get the signature, get the picture, keep moving.
Yeah, it can become very impersonal.
And, you know, I think it was less... You know,
it was less fun for him.
It's like a comic book. It's only good if it's rare. If there's 20 million pictures of people with Stan Lee, it's not.
And that's what we tell people now about the autograph. Oh, but it's. I said there. I am like.
There's a lot of autographs out there.
There's some things that are valuable, but there are also some things that are. But there's also some things that are common. You know, I mean, the joke is about he had nothing to do with Batman. The joke is, you know, there's a Batman comic with Stan Lee's signature.
People have him sign things that he had no connection to whatsoever, and you're like. Why?
You know, when we're talking about the Hulk, obviously you said, it's a Cold War thing. And throughout comic books, that's always been a thing.
Remember when the Russians were the bad guys?
Yeah, the Russians were, and then the imagine? Nazis were the bad guys. Yeah. And like, you can go back and you see,
you could punch Nazis.
You see now that like people today are watching these things they don't know. Like, why does that have to be the villain? It's like, well, that's when this was originally from, this is the backstory. So, with everything that's happening politically today, do you guys see things that are newer, that are coming out of what's going on, and what are those characters or properties like that are sort of tackling today's issues?
I mean,
you said that we have a feminist Lumberjanes, you know, that's certainly on the movement.
A friend of ours, Jerry Duggan, wrote a great series called Analog. Yeah. And I always pitch that one to people because I thought it was such a cool idea. And then again, I pitch it to people as, this is going to sell. And then the guy who did the John Wick movies, you know, bought it to direct. But it was the idea of, in a world where we're all being hacked and we don't trust data anymore, we might actually have to go back to olden times with couriers. Mm. And if there's an important piece of paper that you don't want hacked, some guy with an attaché case is going to have to deliver it, and then those guys are going to get killed.
If you want a message that only the people who need to see it, the only way to do that is to put it on paper and have a courier deliver it.
And that's a case where we saw the title. Like, I saw the title. I knew it was Jerry. I can't remember the artist's name. Yeah. I'm sorry. But you know what I mean? Like, it was like we paid
attention.
Definitely
a better title than Bike Messengers.
Yeah, you know, like. Exactly. It's a guy with attaché case. Yeah. You know, we paid attention because right away we saw good title, good concept, you know, very modern, but also has this great, you know, I pitch it to people as, remember in olden times when they had to bring something to the king, but they were going to shoot that
paper?
Guy, you know, they were going to shoot that guy with an arrow on his way to deliver that document. This is the modern version of that.
No, and there is great, you know, satire. You know, I mean, Mad Magazine has been just, you know, killing it
with political satire. Yeah.
They did an Edward Gorey type of, you know, alphabet kids book poem about the school shootings.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's like,
and it was just heartbreaking.
Harsh in exactly the right way that you need it to be during these times.
A cartoonist who started as a zine, and then they produced it as a full color book called The Unquotable Trump. And it takes Trump's actual quotes, but draws them as facsimiles of comic book covers, you know, and just because they're so bombastic. And so it's like, you know, him as the Hulk, you know, shouting, you know, I'm going to build a wall, you know, or whatever.
And that's one of our most popular books.
It's been incredibly popular.
And kids love it. My favorite thing is when a 5-year-old or 8-year-old runs into the store and goes, oh my God, he's like a cartoon character, isn't he? You know what I mean? Like, they get it.
You know, Pia Guerra, who's the artist on a great series called Why the Last Man, did a whole series of political cartoons for New Yorker and other places. So yes, I mean, you know, cartoons and comic strips have always been used to comment on
absolutely
on the politics and
oh, they've
and
been on the forefront of it this past year. I think I've seen just amazing work,
and and parallel also, yeah, we're seeing more female characters and female creators because they exist, and there was a time when certainly there was more, chauvinism, but it's also part of, I think this industry has been, very, very open to finding
to different
characters.
Voices.
And we're finding that it's also, it's also market driven. It's finding out that,
right.
I mean, girls have always read more than boys in a certain way. So,
but we used to not have enough material for them.
That's true.
We used to have to work hard to find stuff for them. And that's why when something like Lumber Chains came out, we were like, great. I was like, everybody that comes in between this age and this age, I can, and again, boys too, but I can say this is an adventure story. This is, one parent, once I handed it to them and they looked at it and said, oh, this is like the Goonies with girls. And I was like, okay. Good. You run with that. You know what I mean? Like, tell everybody. But that's how we have to do, you're always trying to make it understandable and accessible to people. And when there's more diverse characters and more diverse stories, that only makes it better for us because someone walks through the door and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. And if we have four of us here, like between four different staffers, we can all find a bunch of different material for that person where usually, 10 years ago, we would have been all putting our heads together to find that one thing, that we could give them. And now it's like, oh, wait, there's this, there's this, there's that. Oh, take a look at everything.
I remember watching Big with Tom Hanks, and there's the scene in it where he's pitching sort of the, it's going to be the next.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's sort of a digital comic with, the ending changes.
Oh, God, and right. I look pick around, your own story.
I look around the store, and you're talking about analog. I'm like, we're still in a place that's paper.
Absolutely.
Ink. Yeah. And, is that happening in comics? Are kids reading comic books on the iPad?
About 10 years ago, digital comics, longer, but digital comics, exist and have been a thing. But when it first looked like it was going to explode.
There was that usual panic.
My public comment was I blame Josh Baskin, who's the character, the kid from Big, because coming up with that comics on computer idea. Here's the thing. Yes, all the major publishers all release their comics in a digital format. And unlike, I've talked about this forever, but, to me, there's a big difference between music, which digital music cuts out the middleman. For people who like radio, who didn't really want the album, who didn't want to flip through the liner notes and all that, they're great. Put it in and you get a stream of constant music. That's a great format. Digital for comics is different because that's not how comics are read. You flip back and forth. Most people,
I certainly do. Like, I get a couple pages in and I have to go back and look at something. Yeah.
Who is
for
this
sure.
person?
Yeah, yeah, who is this person that I should have paid more attention to on the first page or whatever?
Before there were pads, I think I was quoted in Wizard Magazine once as saying, well, I think where most people read their comics, they don't want to have their computer with them.
Then the computers got smaller.
But then the computers got smaller, and we're all in there with our phone and their iPad. But it exists. It hasn't broken the market. There was a time about around 2011 where it was nervous making because the publishers were putting their marketing efforts, it seemed, on trying to switch paper people to digital people. Mm-hmm. There was a real, they were trying to get us to, it was crazy.
Well, again, they were aggressively, when you've got a new format and you've invested as a corporation in it, you want everybody on board. Right. And so, for a lot of retailers, that was a moment in time where we were all standing by going, really? Yeah. Are we chopped liver? Like, why do you want to leave us behind? Because we're still the ultimate
place. Do you really
place.
Think you want to give us cards to give to people for free?
Because that's what they wanted us to do.
They're sending us cards to give to people for free digital comics. And we're like, you understand we're not going to do
that. Yeah, that doesn't, it didn't make sense to us. But again, we knew it wasn't going to do away with it because it's a collector's medium and it's a paper medium and books are still more popular than anything else because you can walk around with them and own them and write in them and, really personalize them.
Your digital copy of Rocket Raccoon is never going to be worth anything.
But just last week I was in the store on Saturday and a regular customer came in and the first words out of his mouth were, I read this digital comic, I know I have to have it. So it's a great, as he was saying about music, you know, it's a try. I love the idea that there's a place somebody can try something. Because, yeah, not everybody has unlimited resources. And we all should pick and choose what entertainment we're buying. And if there's a way to get somebody to sample something before they buy it, I have no objection to that whatsoever. And I think it's actually, unlike what you were saying about Los Angeles, there are places in the world, I hate to tell you, that don't have a lot of comic books, where they might be few and far between.
Comic book shops.
I know, comic book shops. Yeah. And so, you know, other countries. So again, I think if the digital marketplace can help somebody who's got an hour drive mm-hmm. to the next comic book store, and they might not get there in the winter, but they can still be reading the product and you know, associating with the characters and enjoying it, and then eventually, if they're on vacation, you know, or they're somewhere, they'll buy something. That's only good.
Right.
And for a lot of collectors, the digital options are like their library. Like they can, you know, especially for older stuff. What's great is the archiving.
Yes, as a reference.
You know, all those old 60s Stan Lee comics, all those old 60s Batman and Justice League comics that everybody. You know, even and if you buy the, you know, the valuable back issue, you don't want to take it home and flip through it. So for a lot of collectors, they have their collection that they value, but when they want to read the story, they can call it up on their iPad.
You can really mess up that digital copy, and nothing happens.
Yeah, I mean, when did Hulk first fight the Leader? I want to read that story again, and you know, within, you know, they don't have to break their back looking through their boxes; they can just pull it up on their computer.
Yeah, we approve of that. I mean, that's, like I said, there's no downside to
that
at all.
Good thing they have our approval.
Yeah. Yes, they need it. Well, yeah, we don't see it as an antagonistic thing. And there was a moment in time where it was potentially that.
Like,
and then
mostly because the publishers were really a bit bold-faced about wanting to, how do we switch the people who are buying from you to buying from us?
Yeah. It didn't feel good. Like, it didn't last long, but it didn't feel good while it was happening.
I don't really want to help you with that.
Yeah. We're going to put these cards in the dumpster.
It was like, can you have a kiosk that leads people to digital comics?
Oh, yeah.
And we're like,
oh, there
no.
were all sorts of things.
Yeah.
We want to put an iPad on the thing that so people can order their digital comics in your store. And we'll give you 2 cents for each comic.
It was just that kind of stuff. So we had to kind of, you know, like when you're in any business, sometimes you have to see this change coming and kind of sit back a moment and go, okay, how much do I have to worry about this? Is this really going to have an impact, or does it want to have an impact more than it's going to have an impact?
Right. So that's why we become more of an event space. And again, a space where people can be a community and come in and go, what else, what's going on? What can I read? And looking for those recommendations. Cause those are still the things that they can't navigate easily digitally.
Yeah, Carr says it's a sports bar, and I always say it's somewhere between a sports bar and like a knitting shop or a fabric store. You know, it's a hobby. You know, it's a place for hobbies, and then everyone in your building wants to talk about what the build, you know, what's going on there. It's not, you know what I mean? It's people are so happy when they're here, and other people are here, and they can see what they're reading and talk about it and talk about the movies. It's, they come here for that.
Well, more impressive than any superhero power is that you guys are a couple and that you do this together, and you seem
we don't kill each other.
Yeah, you seem to not kill each other. You're not even cutting each other off when you speak. Which,
a little bit. I tap him.
My girlfriend and I can't even share an apartment.
I'm like Randy. I know how to do this.
Do you guys have any advice for folks working together, like a couple working together? You guys seem to do a pretty good job.
We've been together a really long time, and we've gone through a lot of different staffs and jobs and all this kind of stuff. And there was one time we had an event here that went like ridiculously well. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's always things that go wrong. And we had one event here once that went really smoothly. And again, we're always
just one.
And it's like that production thing. When you're at the end of it, you sort of go, what did we do right? You know, you kind of take a step. If you want to learn from it and do it again, you sort of have to sit down when you're wrapping everything up and go, hey, that wasn't a disaster. How did we manage to do that? And I looked at him and I said, hey, honey, that day went really well. Like, how did we do this? I said, if we were making a movie today, what would you say our roles were? And without a second's hesitation, he said, oh, you're the producer, I'm the director. And I went, okay. Like, now I get, you know what I mean? Like, if we just stay in that zone and understand, I think the best way to make any partnership work, whether it's a marriage or a work partnership, is expectations and understanding who's supposed to do what.
Right.
If things go sideways, it's because somebody goes, you said you were going to make sure the parking lot was whatever, and I was doing this, and while you were supposed to be doing that. Like, if we set our intentions and sort of go, okay, my job today is making sure everybody gets lunch, your job is making sure the, you know, the VIP guest, you know what I mean? Like, we'll kind of set ourselves and go, you're in charge of this, I'm in charge of that, go.
I think it's, I think it's keeping a separation between the big picture and the details, but it's not always the same person. It's not like I'm big picture all the time and Susan's details all the time or vice versa. It's on specific issues.
Who gets it?
The product, like I'm probably on the product in the store. I'm all the detail stuff.
Yes, but I stock all the alternative products.
Yeah, but exactly. There's areas that you specialize in. So things like that, where it's just like just being able and not, because that way you don't have a if I say, you know, this part of it's your job, then there's not a fight because it's that's her job.
Right.
Yeah, you have to give somebody territory and let them shine and trust them. And, it, you know what I mean? Like, over time, it takes a while to figure it out. And I think there was a time with events, especially, where we were both kind of trying to do everything, you know, and that's a recipe for disaster because
I thought it could be done.
Exactly.
And it was like, you know what? Maybe if everyone's not getting what I'm thinking, then let me see what they're thinking and I'll step aside and watch it and then try and go, oh, that's what you want to do? Okay, now I can help you guys go in that direction.
Yeah, we know each other's strengths and weaknesses after all these years. And so it's kind of easier now for us to, you know, kind of, I mean, we were screenwriting together, which is very different than running a business together. But it's that same idea.
We had Molly Shannon attached to that script for 5 minutes.
And still every time we see her on screen, we're like, Molly loved us once. You know what I mean? Like, I was once at a party where Molly Shannon turned to me and said, that script you're writing for me, do you think it's good for me and my friend Jen? And I went, Jen? And she said, Jennifer Aniston. Is there a part in it for Jennifer Aniston? And I said, yes, Molly, of course there is. You know what I mean? Like, but that's a sideline. But that, you know what I mean? We still have that. We still share that history of laughing about that and kind of not being bitter about it and going, that was, oh my God, that really happened. That was really funny. And that's a good story. And we still have such warm feelings about her from that time period, you know, that we almost did a movie for her and it was fantastic. And it's still a fun thing in the memory box. But yes, what's worked for us over time is figuring out whose job is what and, you know, being in each other's way, but also knowing when to go, oh, that's your thing. Can you go do that? And I'll go do this. And we like each other. Well, that has to be, like I said, that's job
one. Well, I don't want you guys to talk about it too much. Somebody's going to say something like, well, you know.
Well, it's also knowing how to fight and disagree.
That's why I put the microphone farther away.
I want to do a couple quick questions here, and then we can wrap up because you guys got a store to open.
Okay. That's true.
First of all, what's the most anybody's ever came and spent in here? Has anybody ever come in and just gone crazy?
Yeah, there are a couple. I can talk about one because it's actually on the internet. There was a show, an internet show about shopping in comic book shops, and they would take a celebrity. So Michael Giacchino, the composer, who did Lost and who does Spider-Man movies.
Pixar movies.
He's amazing.
Such an incredible talent and nice person.
You know, so he was a customer, and you know, so they asked him to pick the store, and so part of it is they give him money to do a shopping spree. So that was a really like fun, day.
Reality
and
television.
That was a big sale. And there was another person once who,
Every now and then we have a manic person trying to get rid of cash.
Yeah.
And you know, the person that walks in, whether they work for somebody else that's come into some cash and they're trying to buy, they want to buy that asset, like a gold coin. And they sort of walk in and they go, so what's the most expensive Walking Dead comic that you have? Oh, okay, $2,000. Great. You know, because
Bought about $3,000 or $4,000 worth of comics in cash one day that kind of had the feeling that it was like it wasn't so much about the specific comics.
I was like, that person's never coming back.
That they were kind of like, it was like hiding, it was like buying gold bullion.
They were laundering money.
It's an asset. Yeah. It's an asset that you can convert at some point that you're sure is going to stay as it's not going to depreciate.
Yeah.
At the very least.
What is the single priciest thing in the store right now?
Would it be that Flash cover?
Well, the other day we had a $3,000 first appearance of Hulk 181 of Wolverine, which is Hulk 181 that we sold the other day.
That's one of those mythic comics. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it never
so
lasts.
So somebody
long.
Comes in knowing that you have that, or they
yes. Yeah. Sometimes we put.
Yeah,
it
we
online.
Got it a couple weeks ago. We show it off online. I mean, it you know something like it never lasts long because it's one of the most in demand comics. So we put it out there and started getting some inquiries and everyone's like, what's your best price? I'm like, I don't know. I think $3,000 is a pretty good price. That's why I priced it at that. But everybody wants a deal. But it was a longtime customer who was putting together a collection and was very happy to get it. Probably, I mean, part of it's emotionally and part of it is value. I mean, that Flash 123 is probably the top thing right now. It's very historic and means a lot. We have, you know...
I'll have to get a picture of it before I go. That's okay. Without Flash.
Yeah. Yes, no Flash.
No Flash for the Flash.
That would be funny to put that on the thing. No Flash photography. And the priceless thing, you know, we have a joke. There's the first appearance of Car D'Angelo, which is $10,000.
People name characters after somebody named a demon. Was it James Robinson?
No, it was Jeff Johns.
Oh, Jeff Johns.
No, it was a victim. The Spectre, who's like sort of the spirit of justice, basically kills a guy for being a serial killer. I'm a serial killer in that book, and I get killed. But people always go, "Oh, what's that?" And then we explain it's kind of a joke. It's not really 10,000. Yeah. It's basically a 10-cent book, but
it's meaningful to us. Meaningful again, value is a personal. Right.
And we personal do have it. We did some did a favor when Stan Lee had his convention in town, the Stan Lee Comic Convention. We got a gift. We did some work for them and got a gift from Stan, which is like a signed pop vinyl of Stan Lee. So that's probably the most priceless thing, because I couldn't even put
and
a price on
it. Definitely after
that.
He died, everybody noticed it.
Yeah.
You know, it suddenly became much, every single person at the counter suddenly saw it, whereas it had been there for I don't know how long and no one had ever
said anything.
Yeah,
we've had it for a few years. And
yeah, that just, yeah. But you see that happen all the time.
It's like my signed Stan Lee Superman plate, you know?
Yeah, there you go.
I hope that you guys weren't going to – I hope there was going to be a laugh and not get out.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever had somebody come in and want to buy something or buy something and you were like, I don't know if you should have this. Like, is there somebody
Ooh, that's a terrible feeling.
Yeah. You're just a kid who's –
No, it's more if somebody's mean. It's sort of like it's never – you know what I mean? Like, I just – rudeness, it's like, you know, you don't like somebody when they're rude to the waiter, you know you don't like somebody when they're rude to the cashier, and it's sort of like, so or they're rude to their own kid, you know. Most of the time, you know, in retail you see the worst human behavior, but I would actually say as a comic shop, again, being like a hobby shop where everybody likes the same thing, there's a different level of respect for the people who work here. Most of the encounters are wonderful and heartwarming and great. Like, they really are. They really, truly are. And that's one of the best things about it. When people come in here and go, this is my Disneyland. You know, I'm so happy to be here. And that's the tenor for it. It's not somebody buying groceries that's pissed off that the line's too long and they're trying to get home. When people come here, they're here to be here. They're usually not in a rush. Every now and again, we get that person who's here picking up something for somebody and they don't want to be here and they've not put enough money in the meter. And I just always want to go, it's Los Angeles. Either put enough money in the meter or stop worrying about it. But when they're standing in front of the person that's trying to ring them out and they've got that LA face of like, you better help me in this second or I'm going to explode. And sometimes they literally say that out loud. They'll go, I'm going to explode if this doesn't happen quickly because I don't have enough money in the meter. And I just want to like, get out. Like, we don't need you. We don't need you. I don't need anyone who's going to, you know, treat people crappy. And so, yeah, we have those moments where you do what you have to do. And in the back of your head, you're thinking, I feel sorry for every single person who encounters this person today. Because it's not about the receiver, it's about who that person is everywhere they go. And you have to not take it personally. And, you know, but it's always hard in the moment.
I had a guy who was being a real jerk. And the two things that happened afterwards is as he was leaving, his wife turned to me and said, it's not you.
Yeah, I loved that so much. I thought, how many times does she do that in a day? I was like, she might as well get a t-shirt.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I'm like, does she do that all day long as he walks out of building? She turns around and goes, oh, please, forgive us.
And then there were two teenage girls who were there. And after they left, I said, can I just ask what you thought of that? And one of the girls just said, he was so mean. And I said, okay, thank you.
Carl was so happy that he was validated by teenage girls. Like, that they agreed. Yeah, they know mean. He was like,
they're experts.
He felt so good about that. That was the best part of the story, was that they were agreed with him.
So we talked before about, you know, people always asking, like, what's the next thing? What's the next? Not on the what's the next thing, but for people who are maybe not, obviously, because it's hard to be as deeply ingrained in the world as you guys are, but what is something that each of you guys would say, you probably don't know about this, but check it out. This is something I really enjoy.
Well, we got this book for a lot of friends for Christmas this year. Oh. And again, for me, I look for the outer comics things because I was the dragged in person. Mm-hmm. And so we created this store not just for him, but for the dragged in person who I was, the person who is at brunch and their partner, male or female, young or old, goes, I got to go into the comic book store. And they're like, ugh, you know? And so when I see things that appeal to me that can be covered here, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who doesn't like Lin-Manuel Miranda? When I saw somewhere, probably on his
seems
Facebook
like kind
feed.
Of a jerk.
Yeah. The world's most unpopular opinion. There you have it.
Well, he's taking that long Puerto Rican vacation.
Yeah, I mean, what's that guy doing kicking back? Yeah. But, you know, he smartly came out with this book with this fabulous illustrations by his friend Johnny Sun that was based on his Twitter feed of how he used to say good morning and good night to people. And it's very it's very affirmative. It's very positive. It makes you feel really warm and fuzzy inside, and it's wonderful. And I saw that it had the illustrations, and I was like, yes, I can carry this. You know what I mean? If it didn't have illustrations, it would be harder for me to get away with. But when I can send him a link and go, Lin-Manuel Miranda has a book out that has illustrations in it, buy me as many copies as can humanly fit in the store. And so we got it, and I was so excited, and it was a super happy moment for me because we had the book shipped to the store, and I felt like I had, you know, we had established ourselves in the minds of at least our staff as being able to bring in the big name guests, because one of the staff, Robert, who was opening the box, turned to someone else and said, did Susan get Lin-Manuel Miranda to come for a signing? And I was like, yes. You know, I've convinced them I can get anybody here. I was like, no, we just really believe in this book.
Yeah. The last one, I do this. This is sort of the standard question. When it's a musician, I say, you know, what artist or a writer, what author, if you were stuck on a desert island for a year, you could bring as much as you want, but it can only be one, in this case, we'll say property, one character. What Ooh. Are you bringing for your year?
Ooh.
Watchmen.
Oh, I don't know.
Because I can read that over and over and over and always find something new. Can I also bring my Mad Men DVD set?
Yeah. You can't live without men. There has to be man in the title. There has to be man in the title.
Anything's with
man or men, there has to men be in plural. The title. Oh, God. I don't know what it'd be. I mean, in terms of the comics world, I could read Saga over and over and over again for the rest of my life. And for me, Brian K. Vaughan was kind of my literature, you know, my gateway drug to this stuff. And I can still pitch it to people and go, it's Romeo and Juliet with a baby meets Star Wars, you know, and people get it. And for me, that was one where like I was hooked from the first page and I could read it over and over again. And when it comes out, I set aside an hour or two and sit there like it's a movie and I have to go through the whole thing. And yeah, I definitely would want to. I've read through all of his stuff, but I would be able to reread all of his stuff and find something in it every time, for sure.
Well, this has been awesome, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
It's commercial time. Where can everybody find everything that you guys got for the store here?
We are Earth 2 Comics in Sherman Oaks at 15017 Ventura Boulevard and in Northridge, 8967 Reseda Boulevard.
Open 7 days a week.
7 days a week. All seven.
Because he said we had to be.
Instagram, do you guys have a social media presence?
Yes, we're on Facebook as Earth 2 Comics and Earth 2 Comics Northridge. And Instagram is Earth_2_comics.
I hate those underscores.
I don't know. Yeah, for some reason, I don't know why I put in the underscores, but I think I couldn't get it the other way. And Twitter is the same thing.
We're not as active on that.
Facebook stuff shows up there. Yeah.
Guys, events. check out all the social media stuff. If you're in Los Angeles, come to the store. Come browse around. Come buy something. Hopefully, this gets sort of the comic book fans off my back for half saying
I think
there's too many comic book movies. I take it back. Look, we did a whole thing from a comic book store. Thank you, guys.
And, thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
See you guys soon.
Hey, Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turned the volume up high, and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about. I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out, even in a big crowd, cause he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey, Joe, it's time to stop the show. Pack it up and away we go. Donate, cause we almost broke. Everybody, that was Joe.